case, versus USAA General Indemnity.
May it please the court, I'm
Good morning, Mr. Burlington. You know, it's always best if I first recognize you before you start talking, but let's go.
It's nice to be back in the theater of the round here.
Yeah, it's good to have you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Good.
I can hear you fine. We are here seeking review of an order on summary judgment, which we believe is defective legally and factually. The primary legal defect is the trial court expressly declined to consider the totality of the circumstances on the rationale that claimant's attorney testified that she would have settled if the proper disclosures had been made under 627-4137. I would submit that the trial court's analysis is faulty because it conflates the elements of breach of duty with causation. The breach of duty is determined on the totality of the circumstances. The case law is legion and consistent on that point. And no case was cited to the contrary below, and no case is cited to the contrary before this court. So what the judge did was simply focus on what would be the causal issue of but for the bad faith, would the case have settled? And that is an error as a matter of law, and the totality of the circumstances here involve two primary breaches of the duty, one relating to the inadequate disclosures and the other related to the unreasonable delay in tendering the limits. In fact, the trial judge mentioned at page 30 of the hearing that he thought it was too long that they waited to tender the limits. And he did that even though he, in another, we believe, legal error, decided that the 10 days that the claimant was in a coma would not be counted in analyzing the timeliness of USAA's conduct. And that is contrary to Gohegan. It's also contrary to common sense that fulfilling their duty is not suspended because of the extreme injuries of the claimant. They have an obligation from the outset. One of the other persons who was involved in the accident gave them notice on the same day of the accident, and therefore their duty to protect their insured began at that point. One of the other errors in the trial court's order is that it focuses almost exclusively on the conduct of claimant's counsel, which is violative of extensive Florida case law that says that the focus is on the conduct of the insurance company, which is consistent with the fact that the element of the offense was the breach of duty constituting bad faith, not the situation that the insurance company faced. Certainly the conduct of claimant's counsel is relevant, but it cannot control, and it is not in this case, in no way could it be reasonably construed to have deprived the insurance company of a reasonable opportunity to settle. Now, I have done this work long enough to acknowledge that there are pirates in the ranks of plaintiff's counsel, but this record cannot be reasonably construed so as to put Ms. Furman, counsel for the claimant, in that category. As we detail in our brief, she was responsive to contact. She did not make unreasonable deadlines. She did not impose ambiguous conditions. She sent an unambiguous.
Let me ask the question to you this way, and let's assume for the purposes of my question that there's enough evidence in the record to take to the jury the question of bad faith. You also have to establish that the bad faith causes in substantial measure an excess judgment against the insured.
Correct.
Help me understand on this record what evidence there is on causation other than Furman's statement that she said, if I had known in September when the insurance company tendered the limits of the policy that there was no other insurance, I would have taken it and urged my client to take it. Is there any evidence beyond that that shows causation?
Well, I don't think this is exactly what you wish to accept, but there is a duty on the part of the insurance company to make disclosures and to facilitate, act reasonably as a person would facing the possibility of an excess judgment, and act with the diligence and care required.
I guess to sort of flesh out the question, the reason I raise it is, so Furman files suit in state court, says she did it because she wanted to depose two people and hoped to learn in substance whether there was additional insurance, something that she did not get from USAA. She gets an answer to the question, learns in fact that there is no other insurance. This is all she wrote, $10,000. The injuries are, you know, 40 times that, maybe more. She still doesn't accept the offer and goes forward with the lawsuit.
Well, in her,
they argue, and the district judge basically referenced the fact that this really can't be the explanation for why this case didn't settle. What I want you to tell me is what evidence there is in the record from which a reasonable juror could reasonably have found or inferred the requisite causation.
Okay, well, first of all, I have to disagree with the assumption that that could not be sufficient in itself. And the reason is...
That being the statement of Ms. Furman.
The statement that the disclosures were inadequate and she had to determine. But she testified that when she took Dunbar's deposition, she learned other facts about the conduct of USAA that demonstrated that it had acted in bad faith. And this would include the fact that despite the...
For the purposes of my question, I'm accepting that you've got a jury question. To the extent the trial judge said there's not enough evidence to take to the jury bad faith, let's just assume that was just dead wrong. It was a jury question. There were material facts in dispute. For my question, I accept that. My question to you is a different one. Assuming that's so, how do you show on this record causation? Do you rely just on the testimony of Ms. Furman, or is there anything else? I reread her deposition last night, and I was struck with how little substantively she really said about this, to my lights, this basic causation question. What is there beyond Furman's testimony on causation?
I think her testimony is crucial.
Tell me what she says.
What she says
that takes the question to the jury.
What she says is she would have accepted the $10,000 even prior to the date it was tendered, which was much too late, if there had been the appropriate disclosures. And so if they had made the appropriate disclosures, the case would have settled. Then it never would have gone, never would have been filed, never would have gone.
But just to follow up on what Judge Marcus is asking, she, even assuming that to be the case, I mean, she did say that, obviously, but then she takes the two depositions and finds out that there are no other sources. So what is different at that point that allows us to find that there's a material issue of fact as to whether USAA's failure to tender caused her to go forward with the lawsuit against Dunbar?
Well, there is the fact of the delay, but also at that point, she is representing her client, and at that point when the deposition of Dunbar reveals the various other failures of USAA, she has a decision to make of what is in the best interest of her client. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. She didn't set up the situation.
Okay, so what I'm understanding you to be saying is that if she had originally been told this, she would have gone ahead and accepted the settlement, and she wouldn't have sued Dunbar.
Right.
But when time went by and she learned these other things, and then she figured, well, now I have enough that there's bad faith, now I'm going to go ahead and sue Dunbar. So it was, she had two different perspectives based on the time frame, but for that lapse of time, but for that lapse of time there, she wouldn't have had that outlook.
Correct.
That's what you're saying.
Correct. And I think that I think a jury can rationally decide that based on the evidence and based on what was in the depositions. And, you know, this is not a situation of a setup. The trial judge sort of made an irrebuttable presumption that if the plaintiff's attorney does not accept $10,000 in a case immediately, that there's automatically an intent to set up bad faith. There's nothing that Ms. Furman did to lead USAA into the various defaults of their conduct. And there's no basis to put that causative element on the plaintiff's counsel. It's solely on USAA.
Maybe another way to, let me just make sure I understand what you're saying. Am I correct in understanding that what you're saying is that when she originally considered it, she would have settled it because there wasn't bad faith that she could even argue at that time, so there was nothing to get out of it, and it wasn't worth suing Dunbar.
Correct.
But as time went on, and by the time that she found out that there were no other sources of insurance, then she thought she had enough on bad faith, and then it became worthwhile to sue Dunbar. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, because she found out, among other things, that USAA had communicated with Dunbar on four occasions and never even asked for the information that's required by the statute. And and we don't have to get into an argument about statutory requirements, because it's just reasonable, as evidenced by the Harvey case, that this is something that a plaintiff's attorney has to have to even discuss acceptance of an offer. And that is, what is the array of potential sources? So Ms. Furman could not even reasonably discuss this offer with her client until this information was provided. And therefore, USA was the cause of her inability to obtain reasonable consent from her client. And therefore, that is on USAA's conduct and led ultimately to an excess verdict. And I would like to save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Okay. You've saved 3 minutes. Mr. Nordby.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Daniel Nordby on behalf of USAA. The district court properly granted summary judgment on two independent grounds, either of which would justify affirmance. Unless the court would prefer otherwise, I'd like to begin by addressing a couple of overarching principles of bad faith law before turning to the specific application on this record. You've seen in the briefs from the other side that bad faith is ordinarily a question for the jury. Some of the cases say typically a question for the jury, but it's not always a question for the jury. Both this court and Florida's state courts have affirmed summary judgments for insurers in bad faith cases on numerous occasions. Just last year, in the reported decisions of Peleas versus Geico and Aris versus Progressive, Judge Marcus sat on that panel, this court affirmed summary judgments for insurers in bad faith cases where the record supported it. There are earlier cases from this court as well, Mesa and Kwiatkowski.
I don't think anyone doubts that there can be summary judgment in a bad faith case.
Thank you, Judge. So then the question is whether summary judgment is warranted on these facts. And I'll turn first to the question on causation. Florida's law on causation requires the damages claimed by an insured to have been caused by the insurer's bad faith. That's something the Florida Supreme Court stated in Harvey, and it's been a principle for a while.
I'm sorry to interrupt, counsel. I think we're all square on that. The question that I have is based on what your friend on the other side of the aisle said, which was, as a reminder, that at the time that Furman asked for the information, it was not provided. And that if it had been provided at that time, she would have settled the case. And in fact, she testifies in her deposition, that's what she always does. And she would have settled the case, she says, because, you know, basically it wasn't worth going after Dunbar in that situation. But by the time that the depositions were taken and she learned that there were no other sources under oath, that, you know, at that point she thought, well, now I have enough to show bad faith, so now I do have an option. Assuming those to be the facts, it seems to me that there would need to be evidence in the record to suggest that when she originally said, you know, that when she originally said that she would have accepted the offer, that there's something that completely undermines that, because otherwise it seems like it's a material issue of fact. Why is that not the case?
Let me address that in a couple of ways. Like Judge Marcus, I reread Ms. Furman's deposition last night, so let me point you to a couple of points in her deposition. Okay. Pages 51 to 52 of Ms. Furman's deposition, she acknowledged that she did not specifically call USAA to identify any deficiencies in the disclosure that had been provided.
That goes to bad faith. It doesn't go to causation.
So at pages 57 to 62, she agreed.
Well, even before you get on to that, was she obligated to do that?
Was she obligated to?
What obligations did she have with regard to discerning whether there was another insurance policy?
She had obligations as to her client. Of course, USAA had obligations as to its client, and the record, the totality of the circumstances here on the bad faith question shows that the adjusters here...
We know that she asked the insurance company on a couple of occasions.
She did. She asked the insurance company for the information that was
required. Did the insurance company ever say yes or no? Did they ever answer her?
The insurance company provided a sworn copy of the policy that had all of the items that the Florida statute required.
That wasn't my question. I understand that what the statute required, they provided. What I'm asking is, when she asked for something additional to it, whether there was any additional coverage, she asked that question of the insurance company. Did the insurance company ever answer?
The question, Judge Marcus, that she asked is any other insurance coverage that was known. USAA, the record is undisputed, did not know of any other insurance coverage. In fact, there was no other insurance coverage. So, and the additional requirement that Ms. Furman is engrafting onto the statute there is an obligation to affirmatively disclaim.
So the answer to my question is no, they never answered her question because they didn't have to and the statute didn't require it.
That's right. They did not know of other coverage.
Isn't there, help me with Florida case law, isn't there Florida case law out there that obliges an insurance company to find the answer to that question sometimes? I thought there were some DCA cases that said just that. Notwithstanding what the statute said, there was an additional burden reposed on a fiduciary to inquire about whether there was other additional insurance.
So, Your Honor, I'm not sure the case you're referring to there. There were some cases that were cited by my friend on the other side from the Florida Second District Court of Appeal about the statutory requirements. Those arose in the context of settlement discussions, and the court determined that there was not a meeting of the minds behind what was required in a release. I don't know if that's what you were going to or not. But
I didn't mean to cut you off, though, on the answer you were giving us.
Okay. Well, the question, and going back to Judge Rosenbaum's question, I think on causation, was that there was no evidence in this record here that the conduct of USA actually caused the excess judgment here, because
here's what he's saying, right? He's saying that Ms. Furman said, "I would have settled it if I had originally gotten this information, because I would have realized there was nothing." There's nothing else I could do. You know, Dunbar's not good for it, whatever. There's no bad faith, so I would have settled. I didn't get the information. By the time I got the information, because of no fault of mine, it took that long. I thought I had enough for bad faith, so why wouldn't I go after the bad faith part? And so there are two sort of questions to this. The first one is, which I think the district court might have concluded, well, because she originally got the information that there were no other sources of insurance and she didn't settle, that shows that she wouldn't have settled the first time. But I'm not sure that's true because there's a slight difference in the factual circumstances the second time, being that now there's enough for bad faith. So because the circumstances have changed, now she's not going to settle. And if that's not enough, then the question becomes, well, is there any evidence in the record to suggest that we can't rely on, or it doesn't create a material issue of fact, when she testified that she would have accepted the offer when it came in, if it had come in the first time, you know, if she had gotten all the information that she wanted. And I think that's especially the case because she also testifies in her deposition that she does this all the time in her other cases. So I think it would be very easy to prove if she were lying about that, right? I mean, you just have to look at her other cases that she represents people in. And if she doesn't do this all the time, then, you know, you could show she was lying. But it seems like that might be a jury question. Why is that not the case?
Well, the district judge determined that her testimony on that was inconsistent with the other evidence in the record.
Which other evidence other than what I've just discussed?
The evidence of the conduct between Ms. Furman and USAA's adjusters over the course of the proceedings over this 6 weeks between the date of the accident and the date of the tender.
And that happens, though? So when you have testimony about one thing and then there's other evidence pointing in another direction, don't we ordinarily say at summary judgment that that creates a genuine issue of material fact?
Sometimes, but not always. There have been cases, I believe it was...
Right, but cutting to the chase, in order to get beyond that, the other extrinsic evidence has to overwhelmingly discredit the assertion. Right. Now, the trial judge says that, but tell me why this record shows that. That the district court was free to discard the testimony of Furman, who says, if nothing else, unambiguously, I would have settled this case in September when they tendered the $10,000 limit if they had told me in an appropriate way that there was no other insurance out there. That's what she says. So the evidence has to overwhelmingly discredit that. How does the evidence in this case so overwhelmingly discredit it that the district judge was free to take that issue of causation away from the jury and decide it for himself on summary judgment?
What Ms. Furman said in her deposition is that she would have settled if USAA had provided a disclosure that complied with the Florida statute. And then she testified in her deposition at pages 57 to 62. She agreed, going point by point through what the statute requires, that the information she requested, that the information that the statute requires, was in fact received from USAA. The statute does not require the insurer to state that there are no other policies. So her statement was she would have settled.
All of which seems to me to be a better argument for why there was no bad faith than why there was no causation.
Well, I agree. There's some overlap, I think, between the two things because of the totality.
But you would have to concede that for the purposes we're talking about analytically, they are distinct questions. There may be some overlap in the evidence. Ms. Furman says something else beyond the theory that at some point she came to figure out that maybe she really did have a good bad faith claim. She says, if I had known it in September, I would not have spent a whole lot of time and the costs would have been a whole lot smaller than in fact they were. They accrued, they went up in time, and that materially changed the circumstances in the case. That's essentially what she said. Those are my words, not hers. But why isn't that also sufficient to take the issue of causation to the jury?
Well, Judge, the tender of the policy limits on September 15th and then the subsequent conversation with the adjusters there, Ms. Furman stated that she needed to take a deposition excuse me, this is in October after the lawsuit was filed. She stated that she needed to take the deposition of both the other driver, the third driver, as well as Mr. Dunbar to determine whether there was other coverage. She did not indicate any other information that she needed. USAA had already provided her information compliant with what the statute required, which is what she later stated was what she was waiting for. So given those facts, there's simply not, as the district judge found, there's simply not evidence that if USAA had done something different, this excess judgment would not have happened.
Let me ask you a different question, going back to the issue of bad faith. We know from the record that by the middle of the month of August, your client knows, one, that the plaintiff, Ilias, has been badly injured. There are a bunch of broken bones. There's a torn aorta. The medical expenses to date by the middle of August had far exceeded the $10,000 policy limit. And your client knew in the middle of August that the police report had said Dunbar and Dunbar alone was responsible for the accident. He was driving 70 miles an hour, obviously recklessly. His car flipped over, hit one car, went over the median and pancaked on Ilias's car. Why wasn't there enough evidence to take the question of bad faith to the jury insofar as your client delayed from the middle of August when they knew those two critical things, but didn't tender the offer until the middle of September?
So let me address that this way. The testimony of the adjusters, the four adjusters here, was consistent that they look at this in three stages: coverage, liability, and damages. So they determined relatively early that there was not a coverage dispute here. The next question was liability. And they determined by, as Judge Marcus, as you said, by mid-August, that liability was on the insured here, was on Dunbar. Earlier, before August 14th, there was some inconsistency in the stories of how the accident occurred. By August 14th, when they received the police report, they accepted liability. So then the remaining question was damages. And recall, this was a multi-car, multi-passenger accident here. So the testimony of Mr. Raymond in his deposition was that in these sort of accidents, it is the standard practice and it is prudent to get as much information from each of the different parties before assessing damages. Is the driver of the SUV that was originally impacted, does she have a potential claim for damages against Dunbar? Only after both verifying that information about Ms. Brignani and then confirming with Ms. Furman in September with a third adjuster, Mr. Johnson, the nature of Mr. Ilias's injuries, did then Ilias have those three things: coverage, liability, and damages? So that's the time when the full tender of policy limits was made.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Burlington, you've got 3 minutes.
Counsel misstated the evidence very clearly in saying that claimant's counsel conceded that the statute was complied with. She never conceded that. She did not concede she got everything she asked for. USA's attorney in her deposition asked it multiple times, multiple ways, as he's entitled to do. He never got a concession. She was absolutely clear, and it is erroneous to say the statute doesn't require it. Subsection E of 627-4137, first there are five things listed. And then it says, in addition, the insured or her or his insurance agent, upon written request of the claimant or the claimant's attorney, shall disclose the name and coverage of each known insurer to the claimant and shall forward such request for information as required by the subsection.
It doesn't say, though, that if there is no other insurer, they have an obligation to say so.
Yes, and then it...
It doesn't say that, does it?
It says, at the end, it says the insurer shall then supply the information. They say, well, we didn't know. Well, they could have...
But there wasn't any.
Yes, there wasn't any, but they never told us that.
Yeah, but see, that statute that you just read does not say that they have an obligation to tell you there is none. It tells you that they have an obligation to tell you what insurance there is, not that there is no other.
I don't believe that's a reasonable construction of it in light of the fact that there's multiple Florida district court cases that say what the legislature decided here was the information that a claimant's attorney needs to make a settlement decision. And to say that they can remain silent and not answer the question deprives us of information. And even if it's not required by the statute, it is reasonable conduct that any person in their client's, their insured situation would do if they were the one facing the excess judgment and they knew, as they should know, that that's critical. And I would note that in the Kwiatkowski case of this court, a bad faith case, there is a statement regarding disclosure. While all states' response to Rosilla was deficient in that it did not include a statement by Kwiatkowski or her insurance agent about additional insurance information Allstate had in its possession at the time. I mean, even if it's not required by the statute, it's reasonable conduct that they know. If you look at the Harvey case, there was extensive testimony referenced about how this is done all the time, and Harvey involved not just other insurance, it involved other assets of the defendant. And even the defense experts quoted in Harvey as saying, plaintiff's counsel needs this information to advise their client about settlement. And that's all that we asked for in this case. It was reasonable. There was no setup.
Okay, Mr. Burlington, we have your case. Thank you.